Hi, I'm Erwin McManus, and this is the Mosaic Podcast. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And if you're one of our regular listeners, we love the fact that you journey with us. And we pray that every single message inspires you and helps you become the person that God created you to be. Every single week, we send a new message across the world. And everything we do here at Mosaic is made available to everyone in the world for absolutely free. The reason we can do that is that we have incredible people who give generously and sacrificially to make this possible. And I want to invite you to join us. If you're already a giver, thank you so much. If this is something you've not yet done, I want to invite you to start doing that now. Go to mosaic.org/give and give a one-time gift, or even beyond that, become a recurring giver here at Mosaic. And if you're one of those individuals who God has blessed in an amazing way financially, I want to invite you to become one of our partners here at Mosaic. What's really beautiful about Mosaic is that our biggest givers are families who do not live here in Los Angeles, but they are so committed to the message of Jesus going to the world that they support the work here from Los Angeles to the ends of the earth. And so I want to invite you again, go to mosaic.org/give, become a part of our support system, become one of our partners. And more than anything else, I want you to listen to the message, allow Jesus to speak to you in a way that will change your life.
So last week we began together a new series called The Beautiful One. And a part of our hope as we journey through these different encounters that Jesus has with specific individuals is that you might see God in a fresh and new way. Sometimes our view of God has been tainted by our experiences with other people. Sometimes it's simply ruined by the things we've heard about God. So many people see God only as a God of wrath and judgment and condemnation. We want you to see him as the beautiful one, the source of all creativity, of all wonder, of all beauty. But at the same time, one of the unique things we'll discover as we step into the life of Jesus is not only that people began to see God differently through him, but people began to see themselves differently because of him. And so in the most wonderful of ways, we're absolutely convinced that if you'll journey with us, not only will you see Jesus as the beautiful one, but you're going to begin to see through the eyes of God how he looks at you and sees you as one who is beautiful. But what I want to dive into tonight is a paradox of the one who is the most beautiful speaking the ugliest words that were ever uttered by his lips. The words that a person chooses reflects who they are. It's inseparable. Your words, they reveal you, they disclose you. Sometimes they define you, but most of the times your words are an extension of your soul, of your essence. And so we shouldn't be surprised that Jesus is known for beautiful words, that he would speak to the multitudes and call them the light of the world and the salt of the earth, that Jesus would lay out a series of beautiful images of the human relationship with God, and they would be known as the Beatitudes. That Jesus could turn meekness and humility into terms of honor and admiration. And yet there was one moment in Jesus' life where his words were so harsh, so unkind, that they would almost set you back and make you wonder if this is really who Jesus is. What in the world would cause Jesus to say these words? And in fact, throughout history, people have tried to soften Jesus' words because they came so harshly. When I was studying psychology back in college, we were given certain images that we were to look at and give our instantaneous response of what we saw. I imagine many of you are familiar with the image I'm about to show you. It's an image that gives you multiple options of what you can see, and it looks like this. Now, in this image, there are two people, two women, one that's described as the hag and one that's described as the beautiful girl. Now, I wonder how many of you here instantly see the woman who looks like a witch? Raise your hand. A handful of you. How many of you instantly saw the young woman who looks beautiful? How many of you have seen this before and so you chose not to see the hag? How many saw them both at the same time? See, what's astonishing to me is when you're unprepared for this image, most people see the woman that we would describe as unattractive. The one who looks like a witch, a hag, as it has been coined. And it's harder to see the young woman looking in the opposite direction, who looks like she's a part of the aristocracy. And she defines what we normally would perceive as beauty. But it all depends on which lines you focus on. See, if you're going to see your life from the vantage point of God, if you're going to discover the beauty that God has waiting for you, you're going to have to move to the edges. Because if you stay where you are, you'll be spending your entire life looking for beauty rather than realizing that beauty comes more from the observer than it does from the object that's being observed. There's beauty all around you. The question is simply, do you have the eyes to see it? In Matthew chapter 15, Jesus moves his followers to the edges so that they can begin to see themselves differently. They can begin to see God differently. They can begin to see people differently. Beginning in verse 21, we are told, leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. A Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is demon-possessed and suffering terribly." Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, "Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us." He answered, "I was only sent to the lost sheep of Israel." The woman came and knelt before him. "Lord, help me," she said. He replied, "It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." "Yes, it is, Lord," she said. "Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table." Then Jesus said to her, "Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted." And her daughter was healed in that moment. In this moment, everything about Jesus can almost feel as if it's in disarray. How could the most compassionate man who has ever lived speak words like this? How could he speak words so harsh, so uncaring, so inhumane? Well, what we find in this moment is that Jesus is carrying his followers into a new world. And to change their ability to see what God sees, he has to move them into an uncomfortable space. I love how Matthew begins. He says, leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. See, this encounter with this Canaanite woman came from their mind when Jesus withdrew from where he should have been to go where he should not have been. See, they were on a journey between Jerusalem and the Sea of Galilee, and the only way you can get to Sidon is to go 50 miles out of your way. And so clearly, either Jesus had lost his way or was withdrawing so that he could escape the pressure of human interaction and human need and have some time alone. See, in Matthew's mind, there could be no way Jesus would choose to go to Sidon for the people. So he had to be withdrawing, which would make perfect sense. There's so much pressure on Jesus. So many people wanting his attention. So many people with so many needs. Of course, he would need to withdraw. But I love the fact that what Matthew thought was Jesus withdrawing was actually Jesus advancing. It wasn't Jesus getting away from the people he needed to be with. It was Jesus pulling his disciples to the people they needed to be with. See, if we're going to see the beauty that God wants to unwrap in our lives, we need to move to the edges and move outside of our place. Because we all have a place. We all have that place where we're comfortable, that place that we know, that place where we feel secure, that place that has all the right kinds of people and food and environments. And have you ever wondered why God has moved you to where you are? Have you ever felt like, "God, you've misplaced me"? We have so much conversation about destiny. You know, like going for your destiny, discovering your destiny. And so oftentimes, when we think about our relationship with God, we go, it's all about God getting me on course. It's about me being in the center of his will, just moving in the epicenter of God's activity in my life. But I don't know about you, but sometimes I don't feel like my life is a sailboat just moving on glassy waters. Sometimes I feel like my little sailboat is being blown around by typhoons and hurricanes, and I'm landing on shores I don't want to be at in places I never expected to go. Sometimes I'm asking God, what are you thinking? Don't you understand what my destiny is? Don't you understand, God, what we're supposed to be doing with my life? And what Jesus is doing in this moment is he's disrupting his disciples' lives. He's disrupting their traffic patterns. He's disrupting everything and moving them to a place they did not want to be. Or a place they never intended to go. So Matthew writes, Jesus withdrew to the region of Sidon and Tyre. I have a suspicion that those moments where you think you're lost, it may just be that God has placed you in the very place he wanted you, but you did not want to go there. I remember years ago, we went to see El Salvador. I'd been there, of course, many, many times since I grew up there, but I wanted my wife and my kids to experience it. And so Kim and I went with Aaron and Mariah when they were much younger. And some of you know San Salvador is still considered the most violent city in the world, the highest murder rate of any city on the planet. And there were different occasions where we experienced some of those volatile environments. And we went up to the volcano to do a little sightseeing and to see some beautiful lakes. And El Salvador has some of those beautiful places on the planet. But my uncle, who was with us, he remembered this little crater that was off on some obscure path that was now a lake. And he wanted us to go there as well. And so we took our rent-a-car, this 4x4 that none of us knew how to drive, and we burned the stick shift while we were working our way through these really incredibly difficult paths. And after we were stuck in that lake area and finally worked our way out, we started smelling something. And we came off the mountain and came down this road, and the engine began to smoke, and it began to sputter and make these unusual sounds until it made no sound at all. And we pulled over on the side of the road that was known as the most dangerous road in the whole country, leading into the city. It was pitch black. We were out too late. It was late into the night. We knew we should not have been there in that moment. Have you ever had a moment where you're like, really, God? This is how you're going to do this. This is how you're going to play this out. Because there are moments you want to go, you know, I am trying to love you. Right? You know? The only one of us is really cooperating, and I get all this shade in my life about not taking vacations, but this is why I don't take them, because of things like this, God. So I have my family there, and not everyone's happy. And we knew that we're in a really volatile situation with two kids, and all of a sudden this truck zooms by us, just slams on its brakes, pulls up right in front of us. And instead of a whole gang of armed militia, it was a woman. And she jumped out. She started saying, pronto, pronto, vámonos, vámonos, en el carro, rápido. And she was scared to death. But she's telling us to get out of our cars and to jump into her truck. And so my uncle jumps into her truck. And Kim jumps into her truck. And Mariah jumps into her truck. And my uncle's panicking. He says, go, go, go. And they leave, me and Aaron behind. We're just standing there on the side of the road watching the truck just drive off. And Aaron, just a little boy, and he looked at me and he said, Daddy, are they leaving us? Like, that's what it looks like, Aaron. I'm sure they'll be back soon. And they were not back soon. And half an hour went by, and an hour and a half, and I had to develop a strategy, because we're in the car and these guys would walk by with these giant machetes, and Aaron had never seen men just walking with machetes, and that made him a little nervous. And he said, Dad, why are these guys carrying those like giant swords? Like, oh, they take them to work. It's nothing. It's you know. And he goes, oh, what kind of work do they do? You know, machete work. It's you know. And I said, hey, buddy, I just want to like lay out a scenario for you. And he goes, what's that? I said, if I tell you to run, I need you to go run in that field over there. I just need to lay in the field and not come out. And no matter what you hear, no matter what happens, I don't want you to move until you hear your mom's voice when she comes back for us. He goes, I'm not going to go out to that field by myself. I said, you may have to go out to that field by yourself. And nothing may happen. I just need you to be ready. And so that added to the drama of the evening. And we waited and waited and waited in pitch darkness. And then finally, about an hour and a half, 2 hours later, that truck came back and found us. And the woman told us to get into her truck, and we jumped into the back of the truck, and they drove us about a half an hour to their house. And it was a beautiful ride. It was pitch black, and we're watching fireflies light up the sky. And when we finally got to their house, they were the kindest people in the world, people we would have never met, a house we would have never found, a place we would have never gone. And they cooked us a great meal. We had this amazing time. We shared stories. We shared our lives. They talked about their faith. We talked about our faith. We were able to have a conversation about who Jesus was. But how strange that the moment I thought I was in the wrong place, I was actually exactly in the right place. I think so many times in our lives, we feel like Jesus is misguiding us. He's misleading us. He's taking us where we're not supposed to be, but he's trying to take us outside of our place so that we can be in the very place where God could do his most beautiful work in our life. There's some of you, you hate your job. Maybe a lot of you. Like, God, why this job? You ever had that thought? God, why here? Why this employer? Why these people? Some of you don't like anything about where you're at. You hate your job. You hate where it's located. You hate your boss. You hate the people you work with. Has it ever occurred to you that the place you're at is not about you, but the people whose lives you touch? And it may be that God is reorchestrating your life to get you to the very place to pull you out of what would be your Sea of Galilee and move you into Sidon. Last year, Kim and I were actually in Sidon, a coastal city right off the Mediterranean. And I can tell you that Sidon is nowhere near Jerusalem. You have to make an intention to get there. Can you imagine being Jesus' disciples walking, going, you know, Jesus, Sidon is that way, and the Sea of Galilee is that way, and we seem to be going the wrong way, but it's hard to tell God that he's lost. So you just follow him wherever he's going. And here they are in this situation, and Matthew wants us to know how bad it is. Leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon, and a Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him crying out, Lord, son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is demon-possessed and suffering terribly. See, the problem with being in the wrong place is you meet the wrong people. Unless, of course, it's the right place, and so you meet the right people. See, Matthew says there's this Canaanite woman. He doesn't just say there's a woman. He needs you to know she's a Canaanite. It's really, really worse than you think. It was a Canaanite woman. You see, the Canaanites and the Israelites hated each other. They had disdain between them. And the hostility that was carried in the hearts of those disciples would make them have no concern or empathy for this woman. A Canaanite woman comes to Jesus, and then she says, Jesus, son of David. So she gets that right. He's the son of David. He came for Israel. He's the Messiah. He came for the Jews. He didn't come for the Canaanites. Who does she think she is? Crashing Jesus' party, invading his space, and then asking him to help her. That's Jesus, son of David. I know who you are, but I see you, Jesus, and I know you're more than they think you are. They think you came just for them, but I think you came for me. And so Matthew says there was a Canaanite woman, and she says, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is demon-possessed and suffering terribly. Now, I do want to note two sides of this. There are people who are demon-possessed. But also, in that time, everything was attributed to demon possession. When a person had epilepsy, it was seen as a demonic intervention. And so later, it tells us that this woman's daughter is healed. So I think it's interesting. It doesn't say that the demon was expelled from her because there are other places where demons were expelled from people. It says that she was healed, which is very different. But I think it's interesting that it says she's demon-possessed and suffering terribly. I was wondering, are there demons that only make you suffer mildly? It's just a demon that irritates me, but doesn't really cause me great pain. And then verse 23, I think, is the most ominous verse in the scriptures. Jesus did not answer a word. Have you ever desperately needed God? And you made a fool of yourself and cried out to God? Have you ever finally came to the end of yourself and you threw your reason aside and all your doubt and you said, God, I need you in my life, and God doesn't show up? Have you ever felt like you cried out to God, but God was indifferent? Jesus does not answer a word. See, I know exactly what that feels like. I know that silence of God in my life, wondering, God, do you even exist? Are you out there? Do you hear me, or do you just not care? I remember even when I was 10 years old going through my own internal journey, and then as a Roman Catholic going through catechism and my first communion and learning about Jesus in that period of time in my life, but also so desperate to escape my life that I set a plan. I saved money, I scouted out Miami, and I was ready to run away. And I was packing up my bags, and my little sister came and saw me, and she panicked. Well, what are you doing? I said, I'm leaving. She goes, you can't leave. And I said, no, I'm leaving, but I need you to be quiet. And she goes, well, take me with you. And she was too young. She wasn't mature and ready for life like I was at 10. But I knew I had to shake her. So I said, all right, go pack your things and you can go with me. But I did that just to send her off so I could disappear. And instead of going to pack her things, she runs to my mom and says, Mommy, I'll never leave you. I'll never leave you. And I was like, what are you talking about? She said, Erwin's leaving. And I was going to go with him, but I'm not going to go. My mom was livid. She came and found me. She said, oh, so you're going to run away, huh? Like, that's the plan. So it's so bad here that you're just going to leave. Yes. So, well, you're not going to get to go. You're going to stay in your room. Wait till your father gets home. I remember at 10 looking at my mom saying, you don't know how to do this. You don't know how you're supposed to do this. You're supposed to let me run away. That's what you're supposed to do. So you're supposed to let me run away so I can go out there and be terrified of being alone and be afraid of the dark and realize I can't survive by myself. So I have to humble myself and come back home. Don't you know how to do this? Just let me go. She goes, no, you're so stubborn, you would rather die out there than come back home. It was true, I would have never come back. So she locks me in, and I wait all day for my dad to come home. And I had my first conversation with God. This is my first prayer. I just looked up to where I thought maybe heaven was, and I said, Jesus, you are so stupid. It was all the profanity I had in me in that moment. And maybe I can get God mad. That's what I thought. He doesn't seem to be moved by my pain. He seems to be indifferent to my brokenness. He doesn't seem to care about my life. So maybe I can just tick God off. Maybe I can make him mad enough to do something, because there's nothing that is more destructive to the human heart than indifference. It was as if Jesus just wouldn't say a word to me. It was nothing but silence. See, I think sometimes we think God is silent because he's uncaring. I think there are moments where God pauses, where he is silent to allow us to say what we really think. And his disciples step into this moment. His disciples came to him and urged him, send her away, for she keeps crying out after us. See, I think his disciples heard Jesus' silence as confirming their own hearts. We get you, Jesus. We know why you're having a hard time responding, because after all, you're Jesus. But just send her away. And I love their reasoning. Send her away because she keeps coming after us. It's not even about you, Jesus. She's bothering us. This is Canaanite woman with her daughter suffering greatly. She's ruining our day. She's totally messing up our mojo. We were doing so good. And here we are withdrawing. And she has to come and mess up our retreat. Can you imagine getting a private retreat with Jesus? And then some woman crashes your party and makes it all about her. Because her daughter is demon-possessed. Not even thinking about, like, me and my life and my needs. So, Jesus, would you send her away? She's not one of us. See, they couldn't see the beauty that God was preparing because they couldn't get outside of their place or outside of their people. And Jesus needed them to see things from a new place, to see the beauty in people in a new way. And when Jesus didn't say a word, he gave them just enough time to express what was really inside of them. But Jesus made it worse. He answers, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. Going, yes! That's right! See, I can hear it in Thomas's mind and in Matthew's mind. Well, that's exactly what we were thinking, Jesus. You only came for us. You didn't come for her. I don't know what she's thinking. Because that's what the Messiah is all about. The Messiah is all about us. The Messiah is just about Israel. The Messiah is just about your people, Jesus. Just send her away. And of course, she interrupts. And the woman came and knelt before him and says, here's her argument. To this theological position, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. She says, Lord, help me. I love that. See, it's only people who have become callous and hardened by their beliefs that sit around and talk about who God loves, who God accepts, who God elects. When you're outside of God and you're desperate, you have one theological position. Lord, help me. But Jesus makes it worse. After she cried out to him, he replies, it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. You have friends who just, they're just a little too honest. You know what I mean? Do you have friends that have like sort of like minor like Asperger's? Like, oh, dude, don't say that. Yeah, you have friends that don't know how to filter their thoughts. I'm just being authentic. Dude, that's not authenticity, that's rudeness. Some people are like, I'm just keeping it real. But they don't like when people keep it real with them. This feels like a way too real kind of moment. When Jesus says, it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. Who talks like that? Who talks to people like that? Well, people who run for president, I suppose, but... But you wouldn't expect it from Jesus, right? You're like, oh, Jesus. It's almost like we wanted you to send her away, but we didn't want you to kick her to the curb. I mean, that's cold, Jesus. Even like even for us, that's just cold. That's heartless. It's like, oh, man, pull it back. You ever have friends like look at you and go, oh, man, you're fat. What? All right. I just love it when I see people I haven't seen in a long time. Wow, you look old. Oh, thank you. Thank you. What are you supposed to say? Just being real, bro. It's like, you know, Some things you don't say. I keep telling people, telling the truth doesn't mean saying everything you think. Jesus uses the harshest language. These are the ugliest words Jesus ever spoke. How can the beautiful one say such ugly things? See, what Jesus was saying was the common statement of the people of Israel about the Canaanites, the Phoenicians, the Gentiles, the outsider, even women. They talked about them like they were dogs. You don't take the children's bread and give it to the dogs. That was their explanation of why God would only come for the people of Israel. Because you don't take the children's bread and give it to the dogs. I think it's so interesting because I've read historians on this for many, many years. And they try to water down Jesus' words, you know, try to soften it up. It's kind of hard to soften that up. They go, well, you know, the Greek word for dog is actually like the word that can be translated little dog. Honestly, this is what they write. Not like big, bad, mangy dog, but like an indoor dog. You know, he's, it's like, we don't give the children's bread to the indoor dog. The little dog, you're a chihuahua. I mean, Jesus wasn't so cruel to say, you're like a pit bull. He said, you're like a chihuahua. You're a Pekingese. We all hate them. Bam. They say, well, you could translate the word puppy. Really? It is not right to take the children's bread and give it to the puppy. See, we try to soften Jesus' words, and what happens when we do that is we actually lose Jesus' intention. We need to hear the words as harshly and cruelly as they were said. Because what Jesus was echoing were the words of his disciples and what they actually believed about this woman. He was saying to her face what everyone was saying behind her back. Why would God ever want her? Sometimes the best way to deal with falsehood is to bring it right into the light and let what you really believe be exposed. And her response, I mean, really, if that were me, and Jesus said, in my response to Jesus, help me, it's not right to give the children's bread to the dogs. I go, who are you calling a dog? That would be, how about you? Really? You're going to call me a dog? I'm going to mad dog you. That's what I'm going to do. But she doesn't. You know what she does? She says, yes, it is. It's right. Because even the dogs, speaking of herself, even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall off the master's table. Who is this woman? Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table. I'm not even asking you for the loaf. I'm just asking you for the crumbs. Do you realize this woman saw Jesus in a way that not even his disciples saw him? They didn't think God had enough for everyone. They were holding on to their place at the table. Lord, who can sit at your right and your left? Who gets to have a position of honor at your table? We're going to hold on to the table because you came for us. She's like, I'm not even asking you for the table. I'm not asking you for the loaf. I just know the crumbs of God are more than all I could ever hope for or ever need. Who thinks like that? Who sees God in such a way that you're not even demanding a seat at the table? You're saying, I just want the crumbs. I just want the crumbs, Jesus. This Canaanite woman with a daughter who was suffering could see the beauty in Jesus. She could see what was available to her. And somehow she knew what they could not yet understand, that he did not come just for them, but he came for everyone.
See, this is Matthew 15. And when Matthew writes his gospel, he's shifting their view of reality. He's moving them to the edge, not just to the edge of their places and the edge of outside of their people, but he's changing their perspective on reality. See, this is how Matthew starts his book, chapter 1, verse 1. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the same phrase the Canaanite woman uses. The son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. And he ends this genealogy in verse 16. And Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. And Mary was the mother of Jesus, who is called the Messiah. So he begins the Gospel of Matthew saying the Messiah has come. The Christ has come. The Savior has come. And he is the son of David. He has come for us. And he begins the story from where they understood it, but he doesn't end the story where they thought it would go. They were more than 50 miles out of the way. See, by Matthew 28, verses 18 through 20, it says, then Jesus came to them and said, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations. And the word nations is the word ethnos, which means all ethnicities, all people on the planet. He begins by saying, yes, the son of David, the Messiah, has come. But no, he did not only come for us. If you understand who he is, then you must go to every people on the earth. He has come for all of us. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you, and surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. And so right in the middle between chapter 1 and chapter 18 or 28, he writes in Matthew 15, he came only for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. It's not right to give the children's bread to the dogs. So you need to change how you see reality, because they are not the dogs. They are the lost sheep. And he didn't come just for us. He came for them. And I love how the story comes to a conclusion. Then Jesus said to her, woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted. And her daughter was healed in that moment. See, when her daughter was healed, it validated everything she knew about Jesus and that they were afraid of. That Jesus did not come just for them, but that he came for everyone. That he came for us. Jesus only commends two people for having great faith. And neither of those two were his disciples. He commends a centurion soldier, a Roman, for having great faith. Can you imagine how that must have agitated those disciples? Following Jesus around, helping him out, you know, while he's performing his miracles, taking care of all the organizational work when thousands upon thousands of people are being fed with just a couple of fish and bread. But he never talks about their faith. But he looks at this Roman soldier, this Roman officer, and says, you have great faith. Like, no, Jesus, you shouldn't be commending the Romans. They're the enemy. They're over us. And then he looks at this Canaanite woman, and he looks at her and says, you have great faith. And those 12, no, you don't understand. We have great faith. We have the great faith of our fathers, of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. We have the great faith. And Jesus is like, no. She has the great faith. She goes, no, she can't. She's under us. She's less than us. He goes, well, over you, under you, you need to pay attention because this is who you need to become. Because you have a belief and they have a faith. He says, woman, great is your faith. Your daughter is healed. There's something powerful that happens when you see Jesus for who he is. When you see him in his beauty and majesty. When you see him in his compassion and in his kindness. When you realize that he has always been for you. that his love has always moved towards you. I love this about Jesus. Those disciples, they were so entitled, they believed they earned the right to be his followers. This woman, she felt she had no rights at all. She just had a need and had nowhere else to turn. And that was the kind of heart that Jesus was looking for. That's the kind of faith that moves God. In that moment, those disciples had a paradigm shift. They had to begin to see the world in a new way. When they realized that Jesus healed the daughter of a Canaanite woman, and that she had the kind of faith that God was looking for, it began to change everything for them. They realized that Jesus had a different standard than they did. I wonder tonight if Jesus would look at you and say, you have such great faith. See, your faith isn't great because you have so much confidence in yourself. Your faith is great because you have so much confidence in God. See, when you understand that you cannot earn God's love, you don't deserve it. I love this woman just going, I'm a dog. I've heard it all my life. That's all I've ever heard. That's all I've ever known. And for everyone else, that disqualifies me, but I have the sense, Jesus, that you're the one who picks up the strays and you bring them home with you and you make them your own. When years ago, I started a Spanish-speaking church called El Pueblo de Dios. I preached in Spanish every single week. It was just absolutely horrific. I didn't know half the words I needed and half the words I knew in sort of a Shakespearean Spanish. And while I was speaking, everyone would correct my Spanish, literally in the middle of my sentences. And so I would just be speaking away, preaching away. They go, no, es esta palabra. No, no, es esto. And they'd just yell, no, es obediencia, tumbo. And I would just let them. I just adjust as I went. That's how I learned Spanish better. But I figured it was better to give it a broken language than for them to never hear it in any language at all. And one of the crazy things was, our congregation was comprised of people who came here creatively. They were entrepreneurs who did not see boundaries and borders as others saw them. They had great faith and took great risks and went into an unknown world to create a different future than the one they knew they'd have if they stayed where they were. They were known as undocumented aliens or illegal aliens. And it was kind of challenging because we're in a period of time where they were really hunting for people who were here illegally. And they became my great friends. We played soccer together. We shared life together. Their family were friends with our family. They grew up while we grew up together. And it was hard. Sometimes 6 months later, sometimes a year later, sometimes 2 years later, they'd be gone. They'd get picked up by the government and sent back to their country. So we had to have a very specific strategy. We thought, okay, we're never going to really be able to grow this thing because everyone is so temporary. So we invested our lives in them and treated them as if they were all missionaries and pastors and leaders and church planters. We just said, one day you may not be here. One day you may have to go back to your town or your city or your nation. And so we want to prepare you so that when you go back, you don't think you're lost. You don't think that you're in the wrong place with the wrong people and seeing life from the wrong perspective. Say, what we want you to realize is that we're going to pour our lives into you, and then the government is going to pay for you to go on your missionary journey. And so we had... So we saw this as a government-funded missionary strategy. Because if you have the wrong perspective, you think your life is a tragedy. But if you see things through the eyes of God, you realize that everything can be beautiful. That nothing can stop God from creating in you a beautiful life.
Nothing can stop you from creating a more beautiful world. Because what else could you create once you've seen the beautiful one? And you've seen yourself through his eyes. We have a lot of people in the city who are in love with themselves. But we have very few people who actually love themselves. And what happens when you connect to Jesus is you finally discover that he loves you just the way you are. You don't have to work for it or earn it. You don't have to hide who you are. You don't have to pretend that you're not broken. You can just come to him and say, look, I'm a mess. Everything they say about me, it's worse than that. But what I know about you, Jesus, is when everyone else wants to throw me away like a dog, I know that you see in me the beauty that only you can create. Have you allowed Jesus to create that beauty in you?
I want to thank you so much for joining us today on the Mosaic Podcast. As God has spoken into your life, one of the things that Jesus teaches us is that when we've been invested in, we need to also become investors. And I want to encourage you right now, if Mosaic is one of the platforms from which you grow spiritually, you connect more deeply to God, and your faith with Jesus becomes more real, I want to encourage you right now to go to mosaic.org and become one of our givers. Give a one-time gift, become a recurring giver. Mosaic isn't just a church in Los Angeles. Mosaic is all of us working together.